This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. You can access shows live or as podcasts by going online at kuci.org. This is the In the Garden show produced by UC Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners of Orange County. My name is Chris Bonner, and I'm your host for the hour. Today's program is Rare Fruit Growing and features an interview with Greg Rigger. Good morning, Greg. It's so nice to have you here today.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to be back with you.
Greg's a UC Master Gardener and longtime member of the California Rare Fruit Grower, CRFG. He's been involved in field research and fruit growing at UC's South Coast Research and Extension Center in Irvine with persimmons, avocados, peaches, plowouts, cherimoyas, and we'll hear later about some work he's doing with apples. He's also an instructor at the UC Master Gardener Training Program, which is how I met Greg, and he teaches photography at Cypress and Mount Sac Colleges. A variety is the spice of life, especially when it comes to our fresh fruit. I know everyone has gone to the local supermarket and has been disappointed with both the variety and the quality of fruit they find there. Now, many of us will go to specialty markets or farmers markets to get around that, but the home gardener really can take things a step further by reducing that farm-to-table journey from miles to steps and really increase the variety of what they can have in terms of fresh fruit. Today's show is about growing rare fruits and builds on our two prior In the Garden shows. The first was The Backyard Orchard, which featured a wonderful interview with Tom Spellman of the Dave Wilson Nursery. And the second was a show on citrus and avocados that featured an interview with today's guest, Greg Rigger. So good to have you back on the program to talk about rare fruits today, Greg.
We're happy to be here and spend some time with your listeners.
So let's start broad on what rare fruits are, then talk about how home gardeners can connect with like-minded people, and then we'll take a deeper dive into some of the specific fruits that gardeners might enjoy growing here in Orange County.
Absolutely.
So let's start with just a definition. The term rare fruit, we're going to use that term today. In my mind, it conjures up images of exotic, wildly shaped and colored fruit that may look more like art than food. What are rare fruits?
It's interesting, Chris. When I first became a member of California Rare Fruit Growers, I was talking to people and trying to explain to them about the organization, and that exact definition kept coming up and coming up because many people now, what might have been a rare fruit in Southern California in the 1968 when CRFG was founded may not necessarily be considered a rare fruit now because we have learned to appreciate some of this diversity that we can grow in Southern California, and a lot of people already have these in their backyard. What I generally try to explain to people now is instead of thinking in terms of rare fruit, it's more like fruit diversity. And that you can have different varieties of this same fruit. You can have different varieties of citrus, different varieties of avocados, of apples, peaches, you name it. And those different varieties might ripen at different times or, more importantly, have different flavors. And understanding some of those options for you as a home grower will allow you to get better fruit, more flavorful fruit that literally is in your backyard. And there's nothing quite as special as going in your backyard. I was in my front yard this morning watering some of the plants, and I was grazing through the figs and having wild figs for breakfast.
Wow, that's terrific. So you've been a member of the California Rare Fruit Growers for some time. Tell us about CRFG. What's the purpose?
CRFG is a nonprofit organization. It was founded in 1968. There are somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 individual and family members, and it was founded in Orange County area, but it now has 18 chapters in California and one in Texas and a couple in Arizona. They also have members that have moved to other states, something like 47 other states, and even foreign countries.
Amazing.
And it's a wonderful cross selection of skill sets. And as a nonprofit public educational group, they're just trying to make sure that you locally have the best information on what may grow good in your particular area.
So what kind of people belong to CRFG?
Backyard hobbyists, those that like experimenting, like myself, those that like to propagate their own or grow little plants from big plants. We also have government and university researchers. We've had members in Orange County, and I'm assuming in other chapters, that have commercial nurseries or commercial growers. We're located out here in Temecula. We've become kind of the growing center for the Orange County Troop, but I'm equidistant from the San Diego chapter and also the Inland Empire chapter. And we're trying to, once again, enlighten people to some of the great varieties of fruits and vegetables that you can have here in Orange County.
What motivated you originally to join CRFG?
I grew up in the Midwest. My grandfather used to bring pawpaws to me. He worked for the railroad, and he used to find pawpaws and some of the native persimmons, which I now know as Virginianas.
American persimmon.
Absolutely. And I grew up thinking everybody knows what those were, and everybody liked them like I did. And then when I moved in various places growing up, I was in a military family, eventually landed out in California, and was trying to find whether or not I could grow pawpaws out here, only to find out, yes, you can. And I met one of the members of California Rare Fruit Growers, the Orange County chapter, Roger Meyer and his lovely wife, and they started me down that path of learning about some of the things that you can grow here.
So I've been online. I've seen the website for California Rare Fruit Growers. Listeners, if you just do a web search on CRFG or California Rare Fruit, it'll come up at the top of the list, and you can click on that. But, Greg, take us through. Tell our listeners about what goes on with CRFG.
The local chapter, the Orange County chapter, meets at the Orange County Fairgrounds, and they once a month. It's on a Thursday evening, and the third Thursday. And they have, in addition to sharing information, generic information on how to grow things, they also have seed exchanges. There is plant sales. Usually in January, their main meeting is on how to propagate or how to make new plants from existing. In some cases, it's nothing more complicated than taking an 8 to 12 inch branch of a fig and putting it in the dirt, and it will automatically, and it will most likely root, and it'll give you a new plant from that. Other plants are a little bit more complicated, but you also learn how to graft in that January meeting. And then following that meeting, we have an opportunity where we have what's called our cyanwood exchange, where you take small pieces of the materials that you're growing and you label it based on the variety that it is, and we bring them all into one location there at the Orange County Fairgrounds, lay them out on a table, and you're able to get different varieties of some of the plants that you might not ordinarily have from people who are interested in growing things that are typical to what you won't find in the grocery store.
Wow, that's great. I think I saw online there was some sort of a big get-together in San Luis Obispo. Tell us a little bit about what these annual meetings are about.
Yes. Annually, they have what's called a Festival of Fruit. There's roughly 6 to 8 different chapters that are large enough to hold these meetings, and they are held as a public forum, a featured speakers. It's a good chance to get a lot of people in one location. That's kind of a step above the local meetings, as they've also had them over in Hawaii and Florida.
Oh, I like that.
We've even had them in Orange County. I do not know when the next one might be planned for Orange County, but I'm sure another one's going to be happening there sometime in the near future.
And I see there's a number of different types of publications. Tell us about that.
Yes. If you're a member of California Rare Fruit Growers, you're given an opportunity to get either a hard copy of what's called the Fruit Gardener magazine. Some people opt for a digital version of that is sent as a PDF file. There's also a variety of books that they have for sale. There's also what's called Fruit Facts on there. That's some of the publications that have been put together by members of CRFG. And in that Fruit Fact, it covers 44 different fruit facts that are online, and you're allowed to download those at no charge. And that will help you understand not only what do you have, describe the growth habitat, where to plant it, the soil, irrigation, how to prune it, things that might, like pest and disease that you might be concerned with, when to harvest it, and also generally list some of the varieties or what we call cultivars that you may find out there.
Now, do I have to be some sort of special or super expert gardener to join California Rare Fruit Growers?
No, we get people from a variety of different levels of expertise, everything from someone who's just learning how to plant their first fruit tree or fruit-producing plant, to people who have been doing it for decades, to people who are on a educator level where they're trying to disseminate this information. It is a great opportunity to start at ground at the beginning and learn how to do some things, and more importantly, learn that it isn't just one variety that you can get at the store. You can have multiple varieties of things.
So let's guess that there's a listener out there that's interested in growing some of the less common fruit, but they're not certain how to start. Take us through the thought process of deciding what kind of fruit, what varieties, and then selecting a specific variety. How do you decide what you want to grow?
The easy answer to that is actually come to one of our meetings, California Rare Fruit Growers, because we have a fruit tasting table that members will bring in fruit that is currently producing at their home. And that is one of the ways to try a variety of different fruits and to find out what's going to grow in your locality. The other place to try some of these fruits, there's the South Coast Research Station, which I'm sure has been referenced on many of your broadcasts, and that's in Irvine. And as part of their public outreach, they have fruit tasting events. Generally in November, they have a persimmon one, and they just had one here in August on dragon fruit or pitaya. And they also have one sometimes in January or February with your cherimoyas. And those are an excellent way to find out which particular fruit you might be interested in.
The persimmon tasting was the first Master Gardener event that I volunteered at. I think it was 25 or 30 varieties of persimmons. We'll talk more about persimmons later. So I think in your lectures, too, on the citrus and avocado class you taught, I think you made the point of planting things that you like that you're going to want to eat, and maybe with an eye towards what are your friends, family, and neighbors going to be interested in as well.
That's correct. And one of the things that I've learned over the 8 years or so I've been with CRFG is that everyone's taste buds are a little bit different. What you may like, Chris, as a particular persimmon or avocado may not be one that I like. And until you've tasted that fruit, it may not be the best one for you. The other way of finding out some of these things is to go to farmer's market. A lot of times your farmer's markets are picking the fruit when it's closer to being ripe, as opposed to the commercial growers that have to grow it, pick it when it's what's called commercial ripe. And it's not really ripe yet, but it's getting close to it, but it has to withstand the commercial harvesting and the transportation. And a lot of your farmer's market growers have that fruit closer to the optimum, and they're also growing a better variety that may not have to withstand that commercial harvesting transportation.
So in the citrus and avocado class that I took from you, you told the story, and again, just as a background, I'm mostly an ornamental type gardener. So I've got lots of stuff I go for color and flowers year-round. I've got a vegetable garden that does quite well, but I'm not doing any fruit right now. But I got really excited in your class about the idea of what you described as an edible landscape, and you told the story about how your own gardening approach and philosophy had shifted from ornamental to edible. So talk about that shift and talk about a little bit about the whys and wherefores and the benefits of moving towards an edible landscape.
We were fortunate enough to move out to Temecula a few years ago, and one of the areas that we were concerned with was having more land to work with, because we knew we wanted to have a lot of the edible landscape. And one of the first major chores that we had here when we moved to the property was to take out, and we're still in the process of taking them out, but currently we've taken down around 100 pine, eucalyptus, and cottonwood trees, and pulled the stumps, which is a chore out here. Because the ground is basically compressed, decomposed granite. And in that process, we have, over the last couple of years, we're also learning about the microclimates that we have on the property. We are blessed with having a large plateau, a flat area, and off one side of the property, it's a slight slope. On another side of the property, it's a pretty steep slope that we will be putting some contours or some terracing so that we can maximize the 5 or 6 different microclimates that we have here. Anything on the 1 acre plateau will be able to withstand heat. Things like citrus and pomegranates and figs, those are all heat-loving plants. Anything that requires a higher, what's called chill hours, where it needs to have a certain amount of chill, that's going to go on the lower end of the property where all that cold air kind of collects. And so things like apples, stone fruit, we're even going to try avocados out here because we have a small section where the hill that the property is on may help block some of the burning sun from that.
Some of the afternoon sun.
Some of the afternoon sun. And so we're very excited about trying some of these things. Understanding the microclimates that might be on your property is key to going from a ornamental to an edible landscape. Our philosophy is that if our philosophy here, I should say, is that if I'm going to tend to it and water and feed and fertilize and do all these other things to it, I want to have something back from it. And in that process, we want to have that edible landscape as much as possible.
So in having things that are pretty, that are beautiful, that often both offer both ornamental benefits, but also give you something to eat out of it.
Exactly. Why have, in my thinking, why have a large eucalyptus tree which sheds? It's also produces oils which are fairly flammable. Why produce those? And you also have to keep in mind that when you have a big tree, and we took down some trees that were close to 100 feet tall, when you have trees that are that tall, you also have a root structure with that.
Right.
So as we go from trees that could be invasive in their root systems and go to something that we're going to be maintaining the height so it doesn't get that tall, we're also going to have a smaller root system, which is going to require less water, which is going to ultimately be more water-wise out here in our area of Temecula.
The other point you made, I came home really excited about this one, the idea of using fruit trees, and in particular you were talking about citrus, but using fruit trees to provide some of the functionality that our foliage provides us. So I've got a row, like a lot of Orange County people, I've got a row of podocarpus to provide me visual privacy from my neighbors. And you brought up the idea of taking those out and replacing those with citrus and growing citrus hedges to give the same, a nice looking foliage, giving me the visual privacy. But then also the thing that my podocarpus doesn't give me is some edible fruit.
That's true. I got to be honest with you. I'm not sure what a podocarpus is. If it were on my property, unfortunately, it would have been out a long time ago. And I have nothing against people who do like the ornamentals by the same token. It is nice having pretty flowers in your garden, but in my particular case, having citrus, which is basically an evergreen, or having some other things you could also use if you need a privacy area. You could also use something like pomegranates. We're growing roughly 30 different varieties of pomegranates here on our property. And once again, you get beautiful foliage. Yes, it loses its leaves at some point in time, but it pretty much replaces them fairly quickly.
Right.
And more importantly, you do get some edible fruit from that. And so if you think in terms of keeping your fruiting plants and trees fairly small, keeping them pruned back, because you're responsible for doing that. You're in charge of them. And you can really convert them to hedges. I believe you've also spoken to guests in the past, or your listeners in the past, about having espaliered trees.
Right.
Tom Spellman would certainly is a good reference on that. And having a two-dimensional tree sometimes solve some of the problems we have in a typical Southern California property, which I've also had in the past, where you have a narrow strip of land, and what am I going to do with that narrow strip of land? That's a perfect way of dealing with that.
And so like a lot of people, I've got a suburban yard. It's fairly compact. So one of the things, you know, knowing your microclimates, you don't necessarily think about my backyard as having microclimates, but it's really just as simple as every quarter, so winter and summer solstice, and then in between the fall and the spring, doing sun and shade mapping throughout the day, four times a year. Now you know what kind of sun you're getting. And I think to your point on espalier, one of the things I got from your lecture was if I have a south-facing wall, so this would be an interior wall in my yard, and just about everybody's going to have that, I can put an espalier fruit tree on that. I can keep it two-dimensional. I can keep it wide and as tall as my fence is and not really let it come out very far, and I can maintain that shape and that size, and I can have great fruit production and easy fruit harvesting.
Yes, that's correct. And if it is, in fact, south-facing, you want to make sure that it isn't something that's going to reflect a lot of that heat.
Mm.
If that wall has, as long as it has some kind of, if you're doing an espaliate, make sure that the leaves are able to cover some of that wall. If it's a cinder block wall or something like
Otherwise, it's going to heat up and cook the plant.
Right, exactly. If you put fencing in front of it, I had a southwest-facing wall when we lived in Westminster, and I was killing a lot of plants.
So doing an espalier on a cinder block wall or in front of stucco, that's going to be a heat reservoir and it's going to cook these. The temperatures are going to get too extreme, even with the plant in front of them.
Yes, it might, unless it's a heat-loving plant. What I found when I was talked to the nursery about that was they suggested, of all things, an artichoke. And I never considered that an artichoke would do well in that kind of an environment, because I've seen artichokes growing up in the Carmel area.
Right.
And they grow very well up there, but they have the ocean to
right.
provide a little bit of fog. And of all things, an artichoke and a pomegranate did excellently on that wall. They grew to artichoke did about 6 foot to 8 foot tall.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
About as wide, and it just loved that area.
Godzilla artichoke.
Exactly.
You said that fruit diversity was a better way to think about than you know, the transition from rare fruit to fruit diversity. What's the purpose of the logic behind diversification of fruit types and varieties? I know we talked about that in class quite a bit.
Well, one of the things, there's a variety of different websites that will help you get an idea of the harvest times. I have a brochure that I was able to put together from some information I downloaded from Dave Wilson Nursery, and we have their permission to hand it out to both the Master Gardeners and the California Rare Fruit Growers. And in putting that together, I created what I affectionately refer to as the centerfold. And that is their fruit and nut harvest dates. And they've gone to the extreme of actually listing different varieties of, let's say, a peach. And it talks about the harvest time for that area where Dave Wilson Nursery is, which is up in near Modesto, which is fairly similar to what we might have down here in the Southern California area as far as when to pick the fruit. And when you look at that chart, and you can get that off of their website, I can have peaches maturing in May through even perhaps September just by properly selecting the right type of peaches. And that's another reason why you want to try different varieties at the Festival of Fruit. They typically have large fruit tasting tables where you can try all sorts of things. And if you can try the variety of fruit that you want, you might have, instead of having four trees of the same variety, you might have an early, a mid, a late, and a really late variety to where you could extend the time that your fruit tree will be producing fruit that's ready to harvest, and therefore you're not going to have four trees all at the same time and you don't know what to do with the fruit.
But I've only got room for one tree. How do I get four different varieties if I've really only got space for one tree?
Well, that's another consideration, and I understand that space can be a premium at some of your listeners' homes. One of the ways of getting around that is to look at your nurseries for trees that have multiple varieties grafted to one central rootstock.
Okay.
I have done a similar thing to that here in our demonstration area, and I have six varieties of apples growing off of one tree. And yes, those trees are generally a little bit more expensive. Sometimes you have what they call 3-in-1, 4-in-1, 5-in-1, so occasionally 6-in-1. And those are another way of getting that. What you have to be careful with those multiple varieties, whether it's called fruit salad or however they term it, is that one of those varieties may want to take over. And you've got to be a little careful when you're pruning it to make sure you keep that balanced. If you have one particular variety that's wanting to be a little bit more aggressive,
A little happier with your microclimate.
A little happier in that where it's living. You want to cut that back just a little bit more when you prune that. And that will help everything balance out. I have several trees on another side of the road that are multiple grafts to them. And that's one of the concerns I have when I prune it back, is I've got to figure out who's doing what to who. And when you prune back your trees properly, and there's a lot of websites out there that will help you do that, and when you prune your trees back properly, you're going to give it a more stable growing platform for that fruit to develop. If you're having to prop up your tree's branches to keep them from breaking off, you need to make sure that next pruning season you do a better job of cutting those back, because if the branch is too long and it gets too much fruit on it, then it breaks, and then you don't have anything to produce fruit in the future.
In the previous show, Tom Spellman talked about actually planting trees a lot closer together in the space of one tree and pruning them. So it was almost like growing four trees, kind of like it's four different quarters of each in a quadrant and managing it that way. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yes, that's another excellent way to do that. I'm fortunate enough to work with Tom quite often in the fields. He is an encyclopedia of knowledge, and that's where I learned about this concept of having multiple trees in the same basic big hole. You have to make sure that the rootstock have similar requirements. You don't want to put some loves water in next to one that hates water. But as long as they have the similar requirements, I like to explain that to people as thinking in terms of bonsai. A bonsai tree is able to stay small because they keep the tree pruned back and they train it. And when you put two, three, or four trees all in the same larger hole, the roots are all competing for the same materials.
Right.
And that's going to have a tendency of keeping it smaller. They do an excellent job of they have some diagrams on their website where it explains some of your options for number of trees in a hole, espaliered, how to plant them in the garden so you're maximizing your space. The only one thing that I find a little bit more difficult to deal with is the distance they recommend from the trees. They do recommend a narrower distance than I feel comfortable dealing with. I'm very tall and very slender, but it might be a little difficult for me to get in between trees that are only 18 inches or 2 feet apart. So I think of them in a slightly larger area.
Right.
And so that I've got room to get in and there and out. But yes, that's another way of maximizing the space that you have.
So we've mentioned Dave Wilson Nursery. And listeners, you can Google Dave Wilson Nursery. We're not allowed to make pitches for any businesses as UC Master Gardeners, and I'm not, because Dave Wilson is a wholesaler. But the cool thing is you can go onto their website, and they are the premier, the largest fruit and nut tree nursery in California, both to home gardening centers as well as to growers. And you can actually see where they're shipping the different types of trees and varieties of trees. So you can track down and you can find these at your local retail store. So I'd like to take a short station break now and let you know that you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org online. This is the In the Garden Show, produced by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County. I'm Chris Bonner, your host for the hour. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. And you can get a lot more information if you just do a web search on OC Master Gardeners, and it'll take you right to the UC Master Gardener website. Tons of great information, and you'll find links to the extensive publications that UC Research has. And that's really Master Gardeners. What we do is we're basically conduits. We're not experts typically. We're generalists, and our job is to connect you with the best science-based information, or even better, to connect you with the best expert in different questions and problems you might be having with your garden. This week's topic is rare fruit growing, and my guest is Greg Rager, a master gardener expert in using fruit trees to create edible landscapes. Now let's return to our interview with Greg. Let's now start talking about some specific fruit trees that Orange County gardeners might be interested in growing. So persimmons, we mentioned that persimmon tasting back almost a year ago, back last November, offers both edible fruit and seasonal ornamental values. So tell us about selecting and growing persimmons in Orange County, Greg.
Well, you quite often see persimmons growing in many backyards in Orange County and L.A. County, basically Southern California area. Persimmons, to oversimplify, come in two varieties. One's called astringent and one is non-astringent. You may be familiar with the astringent variety. It looks like a large orange acorn. It's got a point at the bottom. And those astringent varieties, if you eat them at the wrong time, you will not eat them again at the wrong time.
You're done.
You're done. But when they are soft, you cannot eat them hard, but when they are soft, they are sweet as candy, and they are a great persimmon. The other variety, which is called a non-astringent, just doesn't have as much of that astringency to them, that goofy taste that you get. And those are generally sized like a tomato. They're a little bit more flat. They have a flat bottom. They look like a tomato. And those can be eaten when they're hard or when they're soft. Fortunately for me, my wife likes the astringent varieties, the one that look like a big acorn. I like the hard varieties or the non-astringent varieties, so it's a good combination there. There is more combinations beyond that point, but generally these are the two type of persimmons that you see. The Hachia is the pointy one, and the Fuyu is the flatter one. And when you're looking at different varieties of persimmons, that's generally what you're going to see. What we have at the persimmon tasting event that's at the South Coast Research Station is some of the other subsets of those. Within those two major varieties, there's some other subsets that can get very confusing. I can't keep them straight without a chart in front of me. But they have different flavors with different varieties of persimmons, and that's the way to try some of those different flavors.
So are they easy? Is this any different? Would you describe persimmons as easy to grow or hard to grow?
I think they're easy to grow. We have a neighbor out here literally down our driveway and up across the street and up the driveway to their house. And they have persimmons that are growing there. That property, as I understand it, was at one time a commercial nursery grower, and they had a lot of persimmons there. And when they asked me to come over and look at their persimmon trees at one point in time, we took some of them out because over the years they didn't know how to take care of them, and they got damaged and diseased and a variety of different things. But the other ones, with very little care, they were surprisingly in good condition. They now have about a half dozen trees, which is fine for their use, and the persimmons are doing very well. As far as the typical homeowner, they, like any other fruit tree, have certain requirements. If you go and look at the California Rare Fruit Gardener's Fruit Fact, you can find out all sorts of information about where to place them, the irrigation and whatnot, that it might be specific to that particular variety of fruit. And that's the best place to get that information.
Great. Let's talk about a common fruit that I think is pretty uncommonly grown in Orange County. When I think of blueberries as something that you see in colder, wetter climates like Oregon or Montana or Maine. And I was surprised that blueberries can be prolific producers here in Orange County. I knew that blueberries do require acid soils, and again, that's always a problem here, well-drained acid soils. And kind of Orange County is kind of the opposite of that, with Orange County soils typically being alkaline and also not necessarily draining very well. So share with our listeners about how to grow blueberries successfully here in Orange County.
Well, the beauty of blueberries is over the years they've developed a large variety of what they call southern high bush blueberries that are perfect for Southern California. There's South Moon, there's Sharp Blue, there's Misty. And the other beautiful thing about blueberries is they do great in pots. You avoid all of the many of the issues that you have when you plant fruiting plants in the ground. You don't have to worry about gophers and a variety of different things, especially out here we have gophers and ground squirrels and all sorts of bad things. But planting it in a pot, now when I say a pot, I don't mean what we now call a number one pot or what we used to call a 1 gallon. I'm talking about something in the neighborhood of a number 5 or a 5 gallon or slightly larger, a 7, maybe even a 10. A half wine barrel would be perfect.
Maybe put them on rollers?
You could put it on a roller if you need to move it around. The one thing you want to have with blueberries is you want to have at least two varieties. That's going to increase your yield. You need that cross-pollination with different varieties.
So I do two pots or can I put two in the same one?
Put them both in the same one. If you actually have a half wine barrel, you could actually have three or four different varieties in there. And once again, you could slightly extend your season by having some that ripen early with some that ripen later and then some that ripen really late in the season.
So back to the diversification, this holds just as constant with all the fruits we're talking about.
Absolutely. And the other advantage of having them in a relatively small pot is every bird in your neighborhood is going to want to share that fruit. And it's very easy. Yeah, actually not. They're going to want to share it. They're going to want to have it all. And it's very easy to put some sort of a netting over a small pot or a half wine barrel on rollers. You can very easily take some PVC pipe, which you probably have sitting around the yard, and construct a framework and then just get some of that bird netting and put over it, and you're done. It's also very easy to undo that when the season's over so you don't have that eyesight or that eyesore of the PVC pipe.
Terrific. We mentioned at the top of the program that you've been involved in some field research at South Coast Research and Extension Center for a variety of different species, and I think you mentioned to me you're involved in a field study on low chill requirement apples. I don't think of Orange County because of the lack of chill hours that really you can grow a decent apple in Orange County. So tell us a little bit about that. What's going on? What the future of apples looks like for Orange County home gardeners?
Well, through the Master Gardener Program, University of Cooperative Extension Master Gardener Program, and through California Rare Fruit Growers, that dual association, I've been fortunate enough to be one of the volunteers there at the South Coast Research Station and have worked with many of the researchers there on several of their projects. They have some fascinating projects that are going on. And one of them that I'm currently assisting with is the high chill apple research project that is going on there. They have 30 different varieties of what is typically thought of as high chill apples. We know that many of these apples are grown in Southern California. As an example, Golden Delicious, John of Gold, Honeycrisp, those are apples that we know you can grow in Orange County in Southern California. But to the best of our knowledge, there's not been any quantitative testing to measure how successful those apples are here. So they started this trial when it's now in their, I believe it's in its third, going into its fourth year. And I was fortunate enough to be one of the people that helped plant the little whip of a apple tree, a single little stick that was coming out. We pruned them back appropriately. The following year, it developed this beautiful, what I call candelabra shape the new branches that were growing out. Now they were all very low. They're getting nice and thick. The following year, we pruned those back and developed what I call the scaffolding. And those trees are now, as I mentioned, 3 or 4 years old. They have very sturdy trunks. The branches are very sturdy. They're all low. They're very easy to pick. People like myself that are well over 6 feet can very easily reach the apples even on the tallest branch there. And that's what you want when you're growing things in your home yard. You want fruit that you can pick, otherwise you're feeding all the birds. And as that trial continues, I believe next year is when they're actually going to have, because it takes a couple of years for the fruit to get, the trees to get to the point to where they're producing a good quality fruit. Next year, next fall, will be the time that I believe they're going to be doing the quantitative testing to see just exactly how much fruit will these trees produce.
Right, right.
And then they'll have a better idea of just how well these fruits are producing trees in Southern California area.
I really look forward to that research coming out. And, you know, that helps drive people like Dave Wilson's nursery to decide what varieties to grow and to offer for sale through their channels.
Absolutely. And we have a variety of different ones they're trying there. In addition to the ones I mentioned, there's a Waltana, there's a Mitsu Crispin, there's Golden Russet, there's a variety of different, the Arkansas Blackspur, which is kind of one that I like, Gravenstein. Once again, these are ones that most of you might be familiar with the names, but typically you only get those from farmers market or from out of area.
Right.
So it's going to be interesting to see how this this trial progresses. So we're looking forward to the results.
Let's make a shift to something a little more exotic with our next less common fruit. And it also has a very interesting historic local tie. The fruit is loquats, and loquats are native to China. And again, they sound like kumquats, but completely different plant families. Kumquats are part of the citrus family, and loquats are not. They've been cultivated in Japan for over 1,000 years, and they're kind of a staple in China, Japan, India, and even now in the Middle East, with Israel being a big grower of loquats. My father-in-law had a loquat tree, and he had it mostly for ornamental value, and it's fairly easy to grow as an ornamental. But it does produce a very nice fruit as well. But this Orange County history tie I found interesting. Greg, tell us about how some of the early days of loquats here in Orange County.
Well, there was a very interesting article. I was not that aware of the history of loquats in Orange County, but in July of this year there was a very interesting article that in Orange County Weekly that came out about some of the history of loquats in Orange County. And to my surprise, this was goes back to the turn of the last century. There was actually even before that, 1890s or so, there was a horticulturist named Charles Parker Taft who was planting loquat groves in the Orange County area. And he felt that it was going to be equal to the citrus industry here. And at one point in time, he had 25 acres in 1915. He had 25 acres of loquats that were planted, and they produced up to 100 tons of fruit per year. It was surprising to me because I did not realize that element of Orange County history. I used to live in Westminster, and that has a very heavy Asian population there, and there almost, it seems like almost every yard there has loquats, kumquats, bananas, and dragon fruit or the pitaya there, and because many of the nationalities that are there have those, they like having them in their garden. I've had a couple loquat trees over the years. I had a neighbor there who had loquat trees, It's interesting to see the history of that. It's one of those things where it has now come back into vogue. I like the flavor of loquats. I refer to them as a Japanese plum. And there are, I guess there's a Taft's Early Red, which dates back to the days of Charles Parker Taft. So I'm interested in possibly trying that variety and just see how good that was back at the time.
I mean, it's, I think, one of the, with fruits like loquats, and again, there's some varieties that get around this, but American taste buds, they seem to like easy, they like pretty packages, they like the fruit to look pretty, and they like to not to have seeds. I call it the immaculate fruit, that somehow they have these great-looking, wonderfully varietied fruits, but they don't have to be bothered with the actual reproduction activity. They don't want any seeds in it, and so typically loquats do have seeds. They are easy to grow, though, and I know There was a quote from a local nurseryman in Orange County. He called loquats the common man's exotic fruit. I thought that was pretty cool. And he also said loquats one of the easiest fruits for beginners to grow. So also can grow in containers. My father-in-law grew them in containers, wine barrels, pretty successfully. You mentioned Westminster, and we talked earlier about some of your experiences there. And you mentioned, and I didn't know this, that there's a lot of banana trees grown in Westminster. And so I did some research on that, not on Westminster, and you're going to talk about growing them in Orange County, but what an amazing story. Bananas were first propagated. They weren't basically at the end of the last ice age, about 10,000 years ago, hunter-gatherers started gathering mutant bananas that normal healthy banana plants were basically all seed, but there were some mutants out there that had a soft, seedless fruit, and it kind of took off from there of vegetatively reproducing those, and now we know that today's banana trees that are in production and in commercial production are pretty much direct descendants vegetatively without a whole lot of breeding going on. And so it's a very interesting plant. We're certainly not tropical. I was surprised when you told me people are growing bananas here. So let's hear Orange County bananas. I want to know a little bit more about that.
Yes, when I first moved to Westminster and I started going to some of the nurseries, they would say, oh, where do you live? And I say, oh, Westminster. And I heard from more than one nursery, they go, oh, you're in the banana belt. And I go, huh?
Sometimes they mean banana belt just means a warm area.
It's an area that lends itself to growing bananas. And the I know of people who live in that general area. Some, if you're too close to the beach, I don't think they do too well. But if you're too much farther inland into areas of, say, Garden Grove or Anaheim, yes, will they grow there? Sure.
More as an ornamental.
More as an ornamental, but they will certainly produce fruit because I've seen them in some of those areas. But that little narrow band, that little microclimate in the Westminster area, it does get a fair amount of fog. It's a little bit warmer than the coast, and it's a little bit cooler than Garden Grove, Anaheim, and those areas up there. Certainly cooler than it is out here in Temecula. We cannot grow bananas out here. We have too hot of summers and too cold of winters, although we do get fog here occasionally. We had fog this morning.
Can you grow the plant or not? You can't even grow the plant.
I only want to attempt to because it's not healthy for the plant out here. It's not one that would do well without more care than I would probably want to give it. But in those areas where you can grow them, there is a variety of different things. And this is one of those examples of seedless is better because the original fruit had larger seeds. And, of course, nobody's going to want to eat a banana that has big, huge seeds in it. The bananas themselves, you can see them all over many gardens in Westminster. A lot of times as the fruit group starts ripening, people will put bags over it. That helps keep the insects off of it,
mm-hmm.
and it also helps the ripening process. But those big bunches of bananas, you see the trees, you see them, and it's just a beautiful thing to see. These big arching bananas. And in referencing bananas at one particular point in time, they talked about the banana forest walking because the banana plant will send out a root that will eventually turn into another banana plant.
A rhizome.
And that will make that plant, in essence, walk as it keeps moving those out. So it's kind of a fascinating concept considering over the years, these banana forests actually walking to a certain degree.
My brother lives in Florida. He's been a grower. He had a palm tree farm, but in his own garden, he has banana plants, and he doesn't really care too much for the bananas that he gets. He likes the foliage, the tropical foliage on it, because of the rhizome growing pattern, when it doesn't look good, he just whacks it down, and another shoot comes up and looks good. After it fruits, the plants can look pretty trashy, too. The weight of the fruits, too, that's the other thing that I think home growers might forget, is a bunch of bananas is a pretty darn heavy thing. And so it's pretty important if you're thinking about this that you remember that as the fruit starts to come, in addition to covering it, providing some sort of physical support in the way of braces to keep that weight from literally it can pull the whole banana tree right over, especially if there's some kind of a wind event that comes along.
Absolutely, and that's another consideration when you're doing these things. You also don't want to plant them too close to any permanent fencing, even cinder block. It can create some issues potentially. That's another, shoring up the branch is also another good utilization of some of those leftover PVC pipes that you might have in your yard.
Right, certainly.
Something heavier than the half inch. You'd have to be up in the
a little more rigid.
1.5, 2 inch, but you could certainly fashion a support from that out of something very easily, inexpensively, and something that you could disassemble when it's done and set it aside until you need it again.
The last fruit I want to talk about on today's show is the cherimoya, and I have to confess I know almost nothing about it. I don't think I've even tasted the cherimoya. But you've been a master gardener long enough. I think we have cherimoya tastings and plantings at the UC Research Center. Tell us about, in the last few minutes here, about cherimoyas.
Well, cherimoyas are a native to South America. It's ironically enough, it takes us back to our beginning of our conversation. It is a close relative to the North American pawpaw. The pawpaw is the largest Native American fruit. They both have large seeds. The cherimoya quite often is somewhat heart-shaped, and I've been fortunate enough to taste the 20-some different varieties that they have there at the research station in Irvine, and it's always exciting. Cherimoya, when you see it in the stores, a lot of times that's the Rosa variety and Santa Rosa variety, and once again, the difficulty with cherimoyas is you're better off with that in your backyard if you like the fruit, because the reason why the stores don't carry them quite often is it has a very, very short shelf life. It will go from brick hard to soft to
overripe
to overripe to fermenting in the matter of just a few days.
Which is, I mean, that's one of the problems with loquats too. They're not, you don't see them in stores typically because they have that quick life cycle of going from green to being rotted very, very quickly, and they bruise easily. So so that this idea of growing things that you can't easily get in a store, I like that, going back to your fruit diversity.
And cherimoya, I can't remember the exact quote. I wasn't prepared for that today, but Mark Twain actually commented on cherimoyas at one point.
Really?
Because he called it fruit deliciosa indeed, or some variation of that theme. And so even back when Mark Twain was around, the cherimoya was known at some level in California. And it's a wonderful fruit. My wife had never tasted it, and she is now affectionately referred to as a cherimoya pig. And we cannot keep cherimoya in the house because she will just love it. It also makes a great frozen dessert.
Its
flavor does not stand up to cooking, so you can't necessarily cook with it. But it makes a great quick ice cream, as it were, by just taking it. We use a colander. We'll cut them in half, scoop out the insides and the seeds, put it in a colander. The colander will keep the big seeds out. The fruit itself will go to a bowl at the bottom. We'll put it in the blender to make it nice and smooth, and then we'll stick it in the freezer, and you have some instant sorbet, cherimoya sorbet, which is to die for. And because it's frozen, it makes great smoothies. If you put it in an ice cube tray or something like that, it's nice small little cubes that you can use as an accent to other flavored drinks, or once again to make smoothies out of it.
Well, terrific. I think this idea of mixing it up in the garden and trying some different fruits and finding some ways to use it and to eat it and to enjoy it, that just sounds wonderful. Before we end the show, Greg, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, one other thing, because and I was just reminded of it when we were talking about freezing your fruit. That's another way of preserving your fruit. If you do have an abundance of fruit, feel free to exchange certainly with your neighbors, because that'll help build up a neighborhood and build up that closeness within a neighborhood. But if you have too much of a given fruit, I find it very easy to freeze it. If you need to pulp it, I find putting it in some Ziploc type bags, a number one or a 1 gallon one, and if you lay it flat when it's freezing, take the excess air out of it. Don't fill it too full. It'll lay nice and flat, and once it's frozen, you can then stand it up on end. And having that frozen fruit, or dehydrated, that's another way of storing fruit. Dehydrators are also very inexpensive, and the fruit is delicious. Most fruits, when you dehydrate it, the sugar content goes right through the roof. And persimmons, as an example, tastes like candy. They're so sweet.
We've come to the close of our show In the Garden. You've been listening to an interview with Master Gardener Greg Rigger talking about rare fruit. Thank you, Greg, for sharing your expertise and time with us.
You're welcome, and I hope your listeners gained a little bit out of this, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
I like to end my shows with this reminder: gardeners live longer, healthier, and happier lives. Thank you for listening to KUCI 88.9 FM In the Garden Show. Tune in every week, Thursdays 8:30 to 9:30 a.m., for another Green Topic.